Support for this podcast comes from Smartwater. Want to get a little more from every sip? Smartwater Alkaline doesn't just taste crisp and pure. It's loaded with everything you need to perform at your best, whether you're running marathons or boardroom meetings. Elevate how you hydrate and pick up a Smartwater Alkaline today. To learn more, visit drinksmartwater.com.
Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu.
Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Hey, welcome to the Long Form Podcast. I'm Aaron Lammer, here with Max Linsky and Evan Ratliff. Hello.
Hello, Aaron.
Hey, you guys.
What you got this week?
This week, kind of a special episode. I talked to Alexei Kovalev. Let me rewind from there. Last week was the week before Trump got inaugurated. There was an essay on Medium. The title was something to the effect of "To My Doomed Colleagues in the American Media." It was about the time he spent covering Putin's press conferences as a Russian journalist. So I called him up in Moscow, talk about what reporting in Russia is like. He's also now reporting for Russian audiences on American politics. So a lot of interesting overlaps here.
Yeah, we don't always get these insights into what it's like to become a journalist in somewhere other than the U.S.
Yes, I wish we did it more.
Especially the week that being a journalist in the U.S. is radically different.
I was going to say, I don't know if this interview was insta-dated or prophetic or a little bit both, but I think it'll be pretty interesting. We're brought to you by MailChimp. As always, they make the show possible. Thank you, MailChimp.
Here's Aaron with Alexei Kovalev.
Welcome, Alexei Kovalev.
Hi, Aaron.
Where am I talking to you from, actually?
I'm in Moscow right now, in my hometown.
You came to my attention because you published a piece this week on Medium.
It's called "A Message to My Doomed Colleagues in the American Media."
There we go.
It was meant as a tongue-in-cheek, and it was penned by an American colleague of mine who obviously meant it in an ironic sense. Because let's just get it out there, I don't really think that the American media is doomed, Trump or not.
Yeah, I understand. I mean, I would say the piece is, I would not call it optimistic, but in some ways it suggests that the challenges facing American journalists currently are not unprecedented. This is not the first time something like this has ever happened. So how did you get into journalism in the first place, actually, is first I'm curious.
Okay, I've been working as a journalist for, 15 years now. And okay. I started in 2002 as a novice reporter for a local daily newspaper in Moscow, and worked my way up the career ladder until I became a senior editor at a state news agency, RIA Novosti, where I was in charge in a website that translates all kinds of articles and op-eds and book extracts and essays from about 30 different languages into Russian.
What is the training like for journalists in Russia consist of? Is journalism school a major pathway? Or
well, it's pretty standard. It's there's nothing really special about it there, because it's really a trade, not a profession. So I never had any formal education in journalism until late 2000s, already 7 years into my career. And I enrolled in a master's program at City University London. When I graduated, I became an editor-in-chief of that website at the state news agency.
For an American, can you give us an idea of what it means to work for a state-run news agency? What is the connection between, say, a website like that and the state? How many layers between you and the state are there?
Well, it was just one between me, and I was literally one handshake away from Putin.
That's not a place I'd want to be.
It may sound counterintuitive, but at the time when I was working there, and I'm not there anymore, but even though we were working for a state-funded, state-controlled publication, we had pretty high standards. And the government didn't really agree with us always, but we thought of ourselves as first and foremost journalists. But the government officials in charge of, you know, micromanaging the media, they had this idea, and they still stick to it, that if you work for government-funded media, you're not a journalist. You are basically a PR guy for the government. So right. You're not to criticize the government or the president. And your mission is just to take the government handout and make an article out of it without going too deep into the details. So that's the way it works now. Well, with nuances, of course, because I know many very professional and dedicated journalists still working for the agency, and doing a pretty solid journalistic job, even given the circumstances.
What precipitated you leaving that workplace?
I think it was a confluence of different trends. We were 2 years into Putin's third term, and they were one by one removing all the little freedoms awarded on us by the ex-president, Dmitry Medvedev. One day we were on our way to work, and we were on the metro, and we found out from Twitter, because everybody else was reporting it, that Putin fired us all, 2,000 people from the agency, fired us by personal decree. He merged a respectable agency, as much as one could be, being a government-funded entity. He merged it with several other state-owned outlets into one huge conglomerate, which is confusingly called, when translated from Russian into English, Russia Today.
Yes.
But it has no relation, at least officially, to RT, the TV channel, although they have the same editor-in-chief. This is very confusing and convoluted.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't think I understand that any better now that we've said it. So for you as a freelancer, well, first of all, now that you're gone, you're giving an interview like this, you're writing stories to your doomed American colleagues. Is there no longer a path for you back to like a state-run media now? Like, is once you're gone, that's kind of not back in your future, or a new presidential administration comes in and kind of wipes the slate clean?
Oh, no, I don't think I'll ever go back there. and not that they are ever going to let me in after what I've said publicly. But it was a very illuminating experience, and I worked alongside some exceptional people there. I'm happy I was there, but I don't really regret going. I'm hedging my risks now. So yes. I don't work for one single publication. And if it closes down, I'll still have others.
What is freelancing from within Russia like? I know you are working, you publish in English at The Guardian. You have what appears to be your own site, or a Medium site called Noodle Remover that you're publishing onto. What is your publishing mix like working as a freelancer?
Mostly I'm specializing in how this massive propaganda mammoth spending hundreds of millions of dollars every year, how it covers domestic affairs, how it covers the foreign affairs, because that's what dozens of millions of my compatriots consume, and that's what forms their worldview. So there's been in the past few months, there's been some explosive interest in this kind of things. But I'm also, for example, every once in a while, I help publications like The Guardian or The New York Times translate their articles into Russian for the Russian audience. And sometimes when you look at the stats, more people actually read the Russian translation than the original article. Because Russians are extremely curious, and I'd say even anxious about what the outside world thinks of them. Because the website I work for, which translates the foreign articles about Russia into Russian, is one of the most popular news websites in Russia.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, I'm going to pause things here to give you a quick word from our sponsor, Penn State World Campus, which allows you to earn your Penn State degree online from anywhere in the world. Over 125 graduate and undergraduate degree and certificate programs, ranked number one for online bachelor's degrees by U.S. News and World Report. So if you are a busy working adult wanting to advance your career or start fresh in a new field, learn how Penn State World Campus can help you reach your educational goals by visiting worldcampus.psu.edu. Penn State World Campus, a world of possibilities online. Again, worldcampus.psu.edu. Thank you, Penn State World Campus. So whether it's your own work or some of this English language work that you're translating and making available in Russia, who reads you? You know, is this a niche audience or is this a dominant audience that's following this kind of stuff within Russia?
In Russia, the state absolutely dominates the media landscape. All of the major TV channels are either state-owned or extremely loyal, because that was the first thing that Putin did, put absolutely all the television in the country under direct control of the government. I would say that maybe 10% of Russians combined consume what we call the independent media. So it's a kind of a limited.
I'm not sure that I would. I mean, the New York Times reach probably exceeds that in America. But if you look at more intellectual magazines, say the New Yorker, I'm not sure, you know, it reaches much further than that. So I'm curious, you got fired along with 2,000 other people. What is everyone doing? What became of all of those people who used to work in that?
Right? Oh, most of them just were rehired back. It's 2,000 people that including the entire technical staff, and translators and editors and everyone. Most of the people working there are still working there, but they got a different logo on the press card.
Right. So this, what you described that as an explosive interest. I think American listeners understand generally what we're talking about here. And I think the propaganda is probably the best catch-all term. This is everything from written about fake news, how sort of small websites publish knowingly often ridiculous news stories, which later filter up to major websites, and sort of there's a specific life that kind of publishing can lead. And then we've talked on this show, there's a journalist named Adrian Chen who was on the show talking about troll farms that are operating in various parts of Russia that certainly played a role in the Ukrainian conflict, and it appears later shifted the focus to the American presidential election. Without sort of commenting directly on, I am curious what you think about the specifics, but when did you start being interested in this propaganda machine and start studying it?
Well, I guess it started back when I was still living and working in London around 2010 and 11. For the first time in my life, I got a different perspective on how I was immersed in the UK media and how they operate. And I realized that most of the things that we see in the headlines in Russia, they are either misreported, especially when I started noticing how the country I was living at the time, how London and England and the UK were being covered in the Russian media. And I started noticing that either get misreported or important context is left out or is just made up. You know, It just struck me that the news that my compatriots consume consists of so much. Well, I'm trying to find a more diplomatic definition, but it's just chaff.
Yeah.
One thing that really just struck me when I was reading a report from another Russian, the state-owned radio, that UK has become so Islamicized that there were Sharia patrols on the streets of London.
Yes, that's a classic of the genre.
Yeah, and I was literally living next to a mosque in London.
Right. So, yeah. Was that something that you previously had been suspicious of, and being in England confirmed it? Or I guess I'm curious, like, how much people buy into that kind of material from within Russia?
No, well, based on my experience of, well, talking to my fellow Russians and yep. to my family members and the friends, well, I'd say, let's say a lot of people buy that.
A lot. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, in America, this story is very new. This mm-hmm. is a story that I think I could have said, I could have described that sort of fake story as being published in news. 1 year ago, I could have described that, and a lot of people would have no idea what I was talking about. I mean, no idea that happens. You know, older people aren't even really on Facebook, many of them that I know. You know, these are things that were, this was sort of an exotic idea. How long has this been a dominant part of the media discourse in Russia?
It's fundamentally different, the media industry in Russia to that yep. in the US. I'd say about 70% of our media landscape is dominated by either directly state-owned media or extremely right. loyal. And I founded it's a fact-checking website. It's called The Noodle Remover because there's a very colorful expression in Russia to hang noodles on someone's ears means to lie, to deceive. Yeah,
that's excellent. That actually translates very well too.
So I'm, well, figuratively removing those noodles from people's ears, because yes. there's so much of those that you, well, you're drowning in those noodles. You know what's absurd? There is a sizable, although very fragmented, Russian-speaking diaspora, but yeah. even people living in Germany or Finland, I can see that on Facebook, they tune in to Russian state media. And they start believing the stuff they're telling them about the country they're living in. This is what really absurd, and it's really disheartening to see how little it takes for people to start believing in something that directly contradicts their empirical facts that they are directly confronting. The Russian TV channel tells you that the pill is red, but the pill in front of you is blue.
Right.
Yeah. It has this effect on people that it completely alters the perception of reality. You don't know what's real anymore.
Yeah. This week we have sort of this news cycle around a report that the Russian state may have compromised Trump. This is all sort of being reported through the smoke and mirrors of an intelligence agency. Oh, yeah. It can feel like when you describe it sort of that there's a fight between sort of truth and fake and reality and fiction. But at least in our limited experience with this stuff in America, it's sometimes very hard to even figure out, you know, what's happening.
I really despise the so-called satirical news now. And I don't read The Onion anymore because the reality is just too absurd to satirize.
Yes.
Because you can see these pseudo-satirical news end up on the Russian headlines and treat it with all seriousness, like this is something that has really happened. So you'll find millions of people in Russia who take The Onion seriously. Because the context of this satire is just far too removed for their reality for them to properly contextualize. I know some exceptionally great reporters from the US and generally Western media working in Russia, but it's nearly not enough to satisfy the informational needs of the American public right now. So what I'm seeing now in the past few months, I've seen such sloppy and bad reporting in the US media about Russia that my eyes bled, really. It really backfires because many of my Russian colleagues are really looking up to the New Yorker, to the New York Times.
Yes.
But the sentiment I'm seeing more and more on the social media this past few weeks and months is that people are asking if these publications, if this very, you know, venerable, one of the most respected publications in the history of periodicals, if their reporting on Russia is so sloppy, how can we trust their reports from Pakistan, for example?
Right.
And this is the sentiment I'm hearing from my colleagues who are the most critical of the Kremlin and of Russian propaganda.
When you read about Russia from within America, what do you feel like is the most wrong?
Well, it's what's wrong with the media in general. It's the same thing that was wrong with the Russian reporting on American affairs, is that you lack proper context and you miss important details, and you have a predefined concept that's completely lacking in all nuances. But that's, of course, because you cannot cram all the nuances, even if you know them, into a short article. That you have to get out as soon as possible before your competitors do. I'll give you a pretty clear example on why context is important. For example, sure. Look at the intelligence community's report on the Russian intrusion in influence on the U.S. elections. You know what I'm talking about.
Recently declassified.
Yeah, recently declassified. As evidence of why Russia allegedly influenced the U.S. elections, they cite a Russian politician who publicly said that he's going to toast for Trump's victory. This was cited as evidence of Russia's plans regarding Trump. But the same guy, he's a 70 years old veteran of Russian politics. And it's the same guy who once threatened to use gravitational weapons against the United States.
Right.
And this is just one of his gems. So you and anyone who knows anything about Russia wouldn't take this even remotely seriously. Whatever this guy says, he's an aging clown. His entire 30 years career in politics consists of these gimmicks. His party, very deceptively called Liberal Democratic Party, its policies are neither liberal nor democratic, and it can be at best described as a far-right populist party. So nobody ever takes him seriously, except for the U.S. intelligence community, apparently. So this this is where bad reporting leads you.
Right.
And we are really in the situation right now when we really cannot afford that.
Right. The New York Times has a story, A1 story today. I'm dating myself when this comes out, but whatever. A1 story today where they basically take one of the most popular fake news Trump memes. Fake news Trump stories. One of the ones that received the most clicks on Facebook.
Yeah.
Track down the guy who posted it. You've seen the story. So in America, that story is almost exclusively reported as, this was just a way to make some money. Whether it's Americans doing it or it's Romanians doing it, it's usually a similar story to like a scammer story. It's like, mm-hmm. This guy is just trying to make some money online. Mm-hmm. Within Russia, in your own research into this stuff, do you believe that this is mostly a for-profit action? It's mostly driven by a propaganda machine, or it's a little bit of both?
Well, the story about the fake ballots obviously ended up on all major Russian media. It was reported in all seriousness, and nobody, except for a couple of publications, issued a correction or clarification that this is actually fake. There's it couldn't be proved. But it also fit nicely into the image of Trump they are building. That he's the victim. He's being persecuted by the mainstream media. They were almost, one of the reasons why I don't believe they actually tried to insult Trump is that I'm seeing it's pretty clear that even if they did try to install Trump as the president of the United States, in the Kremlin and the propaganda machine, they don't have a plan. They have no idea what to do now. Even if they did elect them, they had no strategy at all. And I was watching all the major Russian TV channels in the run-up to the election, and they were so convinced that Hillary was going to win that they were kind of preempting this by collecting all the bits of evidence that the U.S. presidential elections will be rigged on an unprecedented scale.
That's certainly a feeling that existed within America as well. I mean, there is sometimes the feeling that the news is being slightly pre-written and that the shock was genuine, that no one could fake shock so well.
Yeah. So even if they all the intelligence reports are true, and my government did really elect a president for you guys, I can tell you for sure that they don't have a plan and they have no idea what to do with it.
So do you think among journalists who are doing what you define as high quality work, that certainly exists within America and exists within Russia, do you believe that there's an opportunity for collaboration across those lines, or have those medias already been too closely involved with each other over the last year?
This is the question I keep getting after I penned the article on Medium. Is that what are we going to do? How are we going to deal with this president who is extremely hostile to the media? How are we going to cover it? Do you have any suggestions for us? What do we have to do this at his press conferences? But given based on my experience at covering Putin's press conferences, this 4-hour long, extremely frustrating, excruciating ordeals, that you don't actually have to do that. Because in Russia, you definitely do not need access to the Kremlin to cover Putin. And actually, it's a hindrance, because if you have access, if you belong to this extremely small and privileged group of journalists and reporters attached to the Kremlin, that's a liability, because you have to cultivate your contacts in the government, and you don't want to anger them by putting out something critical of them, and you don't want to jeopardize your sources, and nobody ever wants to go on record. It's extremely hard to cover the Russian politics with actual access to the Kremlin, because nobody ever goes on record. But you don't need that access at all, because all the important stuff is the things that don't say publicly, is that what they're trying to hide from the public. And that's what you can cover without any access to the Kremlin. You can cover all the corruption, the mismanagement, the cronyism. You can investigate how it just happens that all of Putin's childhood buddies end up being millionaires and in charge of state companies. You can do all that, but the difference, of course, between Russia and the United States is that you can vote Trump out of office, but we cannot vote Putin out of office, because that's not how elections in Russia work.
Right.
And this is why they aren't really bothered by these anti-corruption investigations, because they know it's not even going to make a dent on Putin's ratings. You know, despite all the revelations, his ratings is in the 96% something. So it's not something you can dismantle with a few hard-hitting pieces in a newspaper that's read by maybe 10,000 people in a country of 140 million.
Yes. Well, I mean, you know, it's not really believed that most of the reporting on Trump stopped him from getting elected within America. But it does seem this whole round of news about this spy document, you know, all of this stuff, people didn't ignore it. Like, people are interested in America. The audience for this journalism isn't like going away, I don't think, at least immediately. What do you expect to be doing for the next 3 years or so?
Well, there's definitely be a lot of ground to cover, because we are stepping into these really uncharted waters.
Yeah.
And there's so much enthusiasm in the air, but also confusion and anxiety, because Russia doesn't really want to be enemies with the United States. It's just the posturing, but they these people in the Kremlin, they do want to stay in power as long as possible and by whatever means possible, but they also want to enjoy the luxuries that only the West can provide, and also be accepted as equals. They long for acceptance. They want to be equals, not just the evil guy who hacks everything and spies on everyone. Well, we can settle for that for a little while, but what we really want to be is equal to you guys.
Right. Where can people who want to read what you're writing in English generally find it?
Okay, I'm reviewing the highlights of Russian propaganda for the Moscow Times. It's a small English language publication based in Moscow. And I'm sometimes contributing to, well, you can look up my name actually on Google and see what I'm up to.
Yeah.
But just keep in mind that I'm not the hockey player.
No, but you. Yeah. I think your Twitter is above his Twitter.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Alexei.
Thank you, Aaron. That was very illuminating.
And that was the Long Form Podcast. Thank you very much to Alexei Kovalev for this interview. Thank you to our sponsors this week, Penn State World Campus and MailChimp. Thanks to Mickey Capper, who edited this show. Thanks to our intern, Courtney Harrell, to my co-host, Max Linsky from Longform, and Evan Ratliff from The Atavist. We will be back next week.